Okay, my name is Chaz Boyd, like it says right there. I'm a program manager from Redmond at Microsoft, and I work on the DirectX team for quite a while. And today we're going to cover a little bit of some of the special coding tricks that you run into when you're making a DirectX game for the Metro environment. This is the second of three talks. We talked a little bit about how to think about your game when you're first trying to create it. And then this one's going to be a little bit about how you code it. And then the next talk will be some optimization recommendations for how to make sure that your product looks as good as it can, but still runs on every possible device. Okay, first we're going to take a little bit of background on the platform that we're talking about today. This is the platform that you use to create Metro-style applications. It's mostly built of what we call the Windows runtime, which is kind of a replacement for what we used to call Win32. I guess Win32 is still out there. You're using it for classic apps today. It's not going away. The thing I wanted to add here is, unlike the other diagrams, I stuck in where DirectX sits, so Direct3D is also available from C++. It's a little bit trickier to get at through C#, but you can do that as well. It's not available through JavaScript. So, fundamentally, you're going to have a killer game, and it's going to require, in order for it to work, you're going to need graphics. You probably want some cutscenes or video animations to happen during it. You're going to need input, so your player can interact with it. If it doesn't interact, it's just a movie. You're going to need some audio for sound effects and maybe background music. You're going to need operating system services that are provided as part of the platform. And then you're going to need services that are potentially offered over the web as well. And then you're going to need some kind of tools to construct the actual product with. So on the graphics side, we've got Direct3D, Direct2D, HTML, and XAML. In this talk, we're going to mostly be covering Direct3D at the top of the list there. For movies and cutscenes, there's this Media Foundation, which is exposed to pretty much every language. It's pretty easy to write a video playback app, for example, in JavaScript. But there's also an underlying lower level layer that that's based on called is DirectX in video there. I need to figure out how to get my mouse to work. Okay, on the input side, we've got a set of APIs. There's an API called PointerPoint, and that is a consistent API that gives you the same software interface for targeting input from a finger on touch, from a mouse pointer, or from even a stylus. To the extent that all three of those can be kept the same, you can write code that is completely agnostic to whatever your user is feeding input through. And then there's also a set of APIs that give you access to the sensors, like the accelerometer and the gyros that are enabled now in Windows 8. And then, of course, there's XInput, which is used to get access to game controllers, like handheld game controllers like on the Xbox. On the audio, we have a very low-level API called Wasapi, which is very foundational. It's very low latency, but it doesn't really do things like mixing or sample rate conversion. So to get those, we use the X-Audio 2 APIs. These latter two, X-Input and X-Audio 2, used to be available from Microsoft only as part of a specific games SDK that was downloaded and had separate headers and libs as part of a game developer offering. But now that we've recognized that games are a core part of the experience in the operating system, those have been brought in and actually integrated into Windows 8 as core libraries as part of the operating system. So that's a fundamental capability that's been added specifically for the game scenario. As far as services that are local to your machine, some of those we've talked about already. There's contracts. There's just the ability for the operating system to launch your application, to manage its execution, to terminate it in a way that leaves the system in a happy state. Those are all convenient things that are already built in. Then, of course, on the external to your machine side, there's this concept of a variety of services that range from Xbox Live and the Windows Store, and then, of course, the Windows Live, which is really the account management system that underpins all of this. Your Windows Live, actually, it's now called your Microsoft account, is the way that you identify yourself to the Metro environment, both for purchasing and distributing applications. And then, of course, there has been a bunch of work done by the Visual Studio team, not only just in creating a tool for creating code, but also they've extended it to let you visualize and manipulate other forms of assets besides codes, like images and 3D models. We'll talk about those in a bit. Okay, now this slide's already been shown today, but the key point of all this is that the Windows runtime is really the foundation of all of this. And then, so independent of what language you use, you're going to be able to access all the routines that are part of the Windows runtime from any of those languages, and they're going to feel appropriate to that language when you do, because the projection syntax delivers the kind of expression that you'd expect. On the other hand, if you want to use C++, if you've got code that's not got some other third-party APIs being called in it, that code will just work as part of the Metro platform. Now, the Windows runtime, the objective of that is to provide your application with access to all the things that the operating system can do for you. We think we've got a pretty good coverage right there. And then you can access those also through different types of languages. The things I want to point out is there are already applications in the store today that are written in JavaScript and CSS, HTML5. And the whole web development story for Metro applications is actually pretty cool. You get pretty much all the advantages of a web page in terms of distribution and ease of authoring, combined with the advantages of an application, like being able to access core functionality of the operating system. So it's a pretty awesome combination there. And then, of course, you can use XAML and C# as well, if you want to have a nice set of UI controls, for example. And then the other thing is, you can also, if you're a hardcore application 3D game developer like Epic, and you've got a lot of C++ code and it's calling Direct3D, well, that works too. For now, I want to talk a little bit about the work that Visual Studio team has done for this project for Windows 8, and it'll in fact affect some of how we see the source code that I'm going to be talking about in the rest of this talk. Fundamentally, the first thing we did is we added C++ language support that is current. So it's been brought up to the C++ 2011 standard, and they've even gone beyond that to add some additional capabilities in the language that facilitate use of the Windows runtime and some of the corresponding APIs like COM objects. It also incorporates new project templates for DirectX C++ app. You can just go through the file new project and you pick Direct3D, and there it is. It'll build an entire framework. You've got a spinning cube, and it's got shaders, and the application structure is all ready for you to just fill in your content. As part of that, you can actually treat GPU code like you would any other piece of code. You get syntax highlighting in the window. When you hit F5, it compiles it, puts it in a file that you can then send into your application package that gets installed in the user's machine that you can then load. So it's treated HLSL, the GPU programming language of Direct3D, is treated just like any other language in terms of the way the IDE works, including packing them into the package. And then there is also some support for not just for actually processing other media types besides shaders, like textures and 3D models. And then also, if you get the pro version, you can visualize those inside the IDE as well. So if you're an art guy, or if you yourself make an art piece and you bring it into the 3D environment, into your IDE, and say, hey, when I run it on the game, it looks like there's a piece missing. And then you can open it up inside the Visual Studio tool and see if the piece is missing from the art asset that was originally provided to you, or if it's a bug in your code. You could tell that just by running inside the IDE. And then it also now includes support for debugging the DirectX pipeline. You can evaluate the status of the graphics API calls that you're sending down. You can look at a particular pixel on the screen and say, okay, what are all the API calls that I made that actually could affect that pixel, and what did they each do to it? So if you find an artifact, you can click on the artifact and work that out. And this is what I meant by some of the improvements that were made. This is the C++/CX or COM extensions that were made to provide a much more convenient syntax for dealing with these objects. When I used to have to do things like sh co-create instance and then have three or four lines of arguments, now I can just, in the new model with C++CX, I can use the COM pointer implementation underneath and just use that line on the right, and that just creates the object. And this ref keyword basically indicates that that object will now be tracked via reference counting, effectively transparently to me, because it's using the smart COM pointers. And for example, it will, if I go out of scope on that pointer, it will actually decrement the reference count. So given all of that, these extensions to C++ give you some of the transparent memory management capabilities that you used to get from, say, the CLR with its garbage collection. But the advantage to using this approach is that it's much more predictable about when it's going to happen and what it's going to do to your user's experience. Okay, so we're going to write an application. First thing we have to do is initialize it. This basically is the structure of your application. The interface from the operating system is, between your application and your operating system, is these five routines. You implement those and you've got an application. The operating system will call each of those routines in the order that's listed there during the process of the life cycle of your application running. So this is an example implementation of the run method. It's very simple. If anybody who's worked with XNA may recognize some of these things, but really this is just, you know, how you keep your app running. This entry point here is where you have the operating system get a chance to process all the events that may have come in from the user as far as an input thing. This is kind of like the Win32 message pump model, except instead of a big switch statement, you effectively actually register real routines as callbacks. So now, when I'm running every frame of my application, this particular loop is designed to run at 60 frames a second, or whatever your monitor refresh rate is. And the first thing it does is check for all the input events. It updates any application state that you maybe have. Then it draws the screen to update the screen, and then it calls this present. And what present does is it takes the final image that was rendered and put it up on the screen for the user to see. And then what it does is it waits until the monitor is ready to scan that image out so that you don't get any tearing. You don't get half of the previous image and half of this image put on the screen at once, which will cause tearing artifacts. And then when it's done waiting for that, it'll go back again. So that's how you know that your actual application runs at 60 frames a second. So I'm going to give a little bit of a diagram here about what happens during initialization. What happens is when the user clicks on your icon, say your smart tile, the first thing the operating system does is identifies a package that needs to be executed, looks in the package, and gets a splash screen out of that package and puts it on the screen. So this is the splash screen. It's a specific size. You know, you need to author one and put it in your app package as part of the submission process. And, that's there so that the user gets instant feedback before the OS has even begun to load any of your code that is the application that's being launched. Okay, and then so that screen stays up during the time your application gets loaded by the operating system. So the actual binaries of your DLLs and XEs, they get put into memory during that time. And then as soon as they're there, your load method gets called by the OS. And that's really the first function that you actually get to do anything significant in terms of work. There's the initialize methods and so on. You can do some things like set up some state potentially, but you really don't want to do anything like, for example, IO until you get to the load function. And then in the load function, you now have control, and you could do some loading. But oddly enough, you don't really want to do any loading in the load function. What you really want to load is the absolute minimal amount of information that you can to get, for example, your loading screen up. So you load the asset that is the background for the loading screen. You load the music that you might want to play during the loading screen, and you know whatever other assets it requires you to draw the actual loading bar. So the reason you want to do this very minimally is to get up to this point is you want to actually run the animation for your loading screen in the run method. Because as we saw in the run routine, you have to call process events at least once every, I think it's a couple seconds. If the OS detects that you're not calling it to do its input processing for more than a couple seconds, the OS will terminate the app. It will basically say it is hung, and it will be, you know, wiped from the user's face. So you want to really do the minimal amount here so that you hopefully can load all the assets required to load your loading screen in well under 2 seconds, and then you can get into running. And when you're in the run mode here, you'll be running the animation while you actually load potentially any interesting game assets like large textures or 3D models or animation data or sound effects or, you know, the whole rest of your level, for example. And then once you've got all of those elements in place, you can switch to your menu screen, which involves a different routine inside the same run method, just having different behavior there. And then when the user actually hits, okay, I'm ready to start playing, then the gameplay starts and you're in typically a different mode when you're actually playing. And then when they hit escape or swipe down, they come back into the menu screen. But that's really the overall, the way the flow is intended to work as our recommendation for how to make these things work the best. Okay, so once you're up and running, you're going to have a window. And the window is going to be subject to different types of events. Like it can be resized for a variety of different ways, either through rotation to portrait mode or snapped or filled mode. It could be moved to a different monitor potentially. Those would all cause changes that you need to know about. And so one of the input event handlers that you register is the view size change that takes into account all of these different variations in what can happen to the shape of your window. The goal is that when these white things come up, they cover up the window. They don't mean that it changed size here. It's just that, just given the options about being snapped and filled in portrait, is two or three or four different sizes that your application is going to have to deal with anyway. So these all come in through what amounts to this view size change handler. It's basically the equivalent of the resize event in Win32. And it's pretty important. It's really where you want to handle almost all of these types of events. The view state changed down here is really just an indication of whether your particular window has focus or not. But so there's reasons why you want to keep track of focus, specifically in the case where you've got two apps on the screen, one filled and one snapped. It's nice to have your application potentially know whether the user is actually interacting with it or the other one and behave accordingly. For example, you might want to dial back some of the crunch work you're doing in a case where you know you don't have focus, just so that the application that does have focus can have a more fluid experience. So for example, what we do in these resize events is the first thing we do is actually verify that the size really did change. And then if so, we null out a bunch of our state and go regenerate it again. This is a difference in the way that you use DirectX than say from XAML or JavaScript. These events are coming in through this interface called Core Window, and Core Window is kind of like a user interface framework that is not really a user interface framework. It's just the absolute lowest level equivalent of Win32. It's not like, you know, you have MFC or XAML or WPF built on top. It's the very, very lowest level. And so a lot of high-performance games, they're not going to spend a lot of time arranging images and dialog boxes and doing control layouts. they just want to, you know, get into that 3D scene, then this is the way to go, is to use these core window interfaces. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't use Direct3D and XAML in the same application as well. There's a sample that shows how to do that. There was a recent blog post on the Microsoft Developer blog page showing the different ways to take a XAML app and make it use Direct3D. The scenarios around that are things like, you know, I've got some, maybe it's a CAD part that I need to have rendered in 3D, or a medical scan image that I'm rendering in 3D, but then I have a whole bunch of controls around the outside of that for doing things like different types of medical scans or different part catalogs. And for that kind of a hybrid application, it's really good to use both XAML and Direct3D at the same time. But today I'm talking about games, and so we're focusing, all of our Direct3D samples don't use XAML, they don't use any other UI toolkit like HTML, they just use this core window API, which is a very, very low level, just gets you the input mechanisms. And then for my focus change handler, this is another convenient thing to keep track of, is depending on the state that you get back from that argument, you can keep track of whether you lost focus or not. And then there's two different ways to regain it. You can either get it back because the user actually clicked with the pointer, or because you yourself activated that window from another window, for example, to switch windows within your application. And then, okay, managing rotation. Yes, rotation can cause you to have to restructure the way your app is laid out, but you have the option, using this interface, to suppress some orientations. As in, if you don't want to handle the case where you're going to portrait, just don't set the bit. So the default for this flag is that it's null, which means your application will support every possible orientation. But if you go and specify individual ones, then only those will be the ones that you'll get sent into by the operating system's rotation. Okay, now we're going to look a little bit at graphics. Direct3D is the graphics API for the Metro environment if you want to do 3D graphics. It's the same in classic and desktop as well. It's the same API that, you know, the latest things like Left 4 Dead or high-end 3D games would use. However, we only support in the Metro environment the latest version of Direct3D. We don't support DX9 or 10. We just support DX11. Of course, to do that, it means that we have modes of DX11 that allow it to target different generations of hardware, which have slightly different or smaller feature sets as you go back. We'll see a lot more detail on this in the last talk today. It has been optimized for Windows 8, but I'm going to talk about some of the key things that you do. And so fundamentally, when you're creating an application like this, and the way our example applications and samples and the template that comes from File New Project all work, is we need a way to take the window that comes from the operating system and the output that Direct3D renders to, and make sure those are the same thing. And that's what this create swap chain entry point does. Really, it's the key way that you connect the Metro environment in terms of the core window messages and then Direct3D together. And so all of our sample code shows how to do this, but effectively you pass in the core window, that is your window that you got from the from the OS when it initialized your application, and you tell Direct3D and say, hey, okay, this is what I want you to render to. And then from then on, anything you draw with Direct3D using the GPU, which can have like teraflops of performance, will all show up in your nice Metro-style core window rectangle. Okay, and so this is an example of the actual render routine that that we use in a lot of our routines. The first thing we do is we actually make sure that the renderer knows which is the video memory surface that we're actually going to be rendering to. Typically, that's one of the elements in the swap chain that we just created. Typically, in Direct3D, you're going to render into what we call a double buffer set of images. And so you're always rendering to one while the other is being presented by the operating system. And this first routine makes sure that we're defining what exactly we're rendering to. We have to do that every frame because we want to make sure that it's established correctly. Then I have some logic in here which basically bails in the case where my assets aren't there. So the scenario is that if I'm just going to clear, I just may want to clear the screen, if my parallel tasks that I've submitted to go load my assets asynchronously have not completed yet, I want to make sure that I don't try and draw a bunch of null pointers. But assuming that works, then I'm going to have as return back from my asset pipeline, my objects that are part of the 3D application will come back as a set of vertex buffers and index buffers. And we'll show you how that works in a little bit too. But those are really what you then pass into Direct3D and have it draw. You're also going to set up to tell it whether you're drawing triangles or lines, then specify sort of the structure of your vertex buffer, where the position element is and where the color elements are, for example. You probably have some constant buffers that you want to set that control what happens in your shaders. Then you set your shaders, and then you draw. So that's really the essence of the Direct3D pipeline. Now you're 3D experts. You can draw 3D objects. The samples fill in some more of the details. Okay, so one of the things I want to point out is there is this concept of the process lifetime manager. And other talks today have mentioned this. But really, this is a mechanism by which the operating system makes sure that the user's experience is always the best it can be. So fundamentally, what happens is if your application is foreground, every other application is being throttled back. Typically, what will happen is that when your application loses foreground and gets occluded, maybe it gets pushed off to the side, the operating system says, hey, nobody's looking at this anymore, and it stops executing its threads. So it's not going to slow anything down because no compute cycles are spent on that application. Now, it hasn't necessarily given up its memory, so it means that if you swipe back to that application through the new touch UI, it's all there, and those threads can start getting executed again. The user has no idea that, you know, that it wasn't running the whole time. But the issue is that when it's behind there, it's in this what we call the suspended state where there is no execution being applied to that code base. But there is a chance that, say, in the case where your application has consumed a lot of memory, that the foreground process may want even more memory than is available, and so your application will get terminated. There's a bunch of rules that determine how this exactly happens, but the point from a programming perspective is you can't really tell when you get suspended whether you're going to be suspended and brought back or whether you're going to be suspended and then terminated. So you have to set up your application code in such a way that you always assume that you will be terminated after being suspended. And so what that means is that you're going to have to persist any state that the user cares about, say how far they made it through the level, what position they're in, where all the bullets are, where the enemies are. All that information has to be saved out in a way that it can be brought back again. So your application will say, okay, I'm being suspended, I'm going to save out this state, and then if it gets terminated, when I come back and I'm loaded again, I'll reload all that state, I'll check to make sure that it was there, and I'll load it all. And then the goal for the Metro environment is for the user to never know that applications even can stop running. It's to make it look like they're always running all the time. And just get rid of this whole save your data and start your application thing, just make that all go away, if you want. So just make it so they don't have to deal with that if they don't want to. And so in some cases, if you've got a lot of state that you want to suspend in your application, save when your application gets suspended, you may need to be saving parts of it during gameplay itself. So you want to be streaming every time the person gets to a checkpoint or to a waypoint, or if there's a large amount of data, you know, you save at those points. If it's a small amount of data, you might be able to save a little bit of it every frame. And that way, when you get to the suspend state, you won't have a lot of work to do, because one of the tricks is the suspend state is a finite duration, and if you spend more than a few seconds in that state, the operating system will kill you, because again, you're not responding to application input in that state. So let's take a look at, before we get into persistence, I need to talk about the concurrency model. These are really one of the slick new things that have been added to the model here. They come from the concurrency runtime, which is a set of technologies developed in Microsoft. And what it boils down to is there's now this concept of a task object. And you can define a task. In this case, we're creating a task that contains a Lambda object, which is really just a routine that is now treatable like data. And this Lambda object basically executes this function and then waits. This is like the await clause in C# or the promises in JavaScript. And so what will happen is, I've got some art here that might help to explain things. You're always have multiple threads available. So the main thread will be going along, and it'll recognize that, hey, this task foo isn't something I want to do right now. It needs to keep going. So this guarantees that your user inputs will always be responded to, because this thread always stays active. It never blocks, even if any of these functions could take like several seconds to complete. But then this task thread that's going to execute foo can go off and run in parallel and do that work. And then it guarantees that the second task called bar will not get executed until foo has returned, because it creates it using the dot then clause, which instantiates another Lambda that contains the bar function. And then that, of course, will guarantee that this third function does not get executed until that one's complete. But the point of all this is, it's a relatively short syntax that gives you a very fine-grained control over distributing tasks onto multiple threads. And the goal of all that is to make sure, again, that your main thread never has to block for any of those guys. It just means that you may not have all your data yet, but your application will still keep running. It'll still keep responding to user events. So the first sort of application of scenario that might actually involve a significant amount of time is saving out some of that state we just talked about, like when I'm getting suspended. So this is my onSuspending handler, where I'm going to write out my state because I know I'm getting suspended. And the first thing I do there is I create this deferral object, which is just kind of a handle that the operating system can know to wait on until I'm done. Because when I'm done, I'm going to say, okay, deferral is complete. I call that handle, and then the OS knows that this thing is done. Okay. And once I've got that, I have this Lambda in here that where I save my data. In this case, I'm saving a very small amount of state. Like there's these application data settings areas in the operating system that allow you to save state. It's kind of like the registry. I don't think it's implemented using the registry, but you can save values in there, and it's very quick and very easy to get them in and get them out, and they persist. And in fact, there's a local version, and then there's the roaming version. So if there's something where I want to have it save just specifically to this machine, I use the local. If I want it to be roamed to every other machine that same user account logs into, then I can do that as well. And anyway, when I'm done, I tell the OS that I'm done by calling this deferral, which is waited in the then block, and I'm okay. And again, if that didn't take more than a few seconds, then I'm happy. And for loading data, I have exact same issue. In this case, I just submit a deferred task object. I don't need to worry about deferrals, but I need to set my own flag. So this is what we had in the render call that detects whether my loading was actually complete or not before it actually tries to draw things. This is an example of loading a significant data set. For example, a lot of games will have a skybox that's the background for everything that happens in that game. It's often a pretty big file. This is what the file sky.dds contains in this case. So there are a variety of different steps that I need to go through to load this data. And if I use the task model with the then clause, I can guarantee that they all happen in the right order, as in I don't start trying to use data before it's being loaded. Okay, now we're going to talk about putting input in the application. Games tend to need input, otherwise they're called movies. So this is another key capability of this interface that we call Core Window, which kind of like Win32 takes mouse events, this takes what we call pointer events, which can mean finger, stylus, or mouse. We've got this generic concept of a pointer. And the way it works is we register the event using the plus equal syntax, like we register all of our events using the new model, new syntax for C++. And we register this on pointer press routine, which first thing it does is it gets passed in arguments that tell you where the pointer was when it was clicked, whether it was a mouse or a stylus or a finger. And then you can save that, and I save it in this float2 object and save it out here in my one of my variables to use next time around. The interesting thing about this is by checking the other fields in this event arg struct, you can identify, if you need to, whether it was a finger or a mouse pointer or a stylus that caused that event, and potentially do different things in those cases. Although, you know, from a user interface perspective, it's a little confusing to have different things happen depending on what kind of tool you're using. And also you can keep track of not just where that point was that was clicked, but the user interface routines of the operating system track multiple fingers and multiple input devices. So you could have like five fingers on the screen, and then every frame when you come through here, you check the pointer IDs of them, it will have those associated with the corresponding finger automatically. It's not like it was in Windows 7 where you had to do a search to figure out which input event mapped to which finger. And then we have keyboard pulling routines, which are really nice for games. You can just say, okay, is the forward button down, is the back button down, and then, you know, execute the right thing right away. Now I'm going to talk about the other input mechanisms based on the sensor hardware. Fundamentally, the new operating system supports all three of these devices: an accelerometer, which tells you which direction gravity is pulling in, a gyro, which can actually measure the rate of turning of the device, how fast you're turning it in some direction, and then a magnetometer, which is, you know, which way is north. And so the operating system, you know, you can find out where all those are, you can query that information and get that information directly, or you can use this API called Sensor Fusion, in which the hardware company that made these provides a driver that combines the output of all three of them into a single unified result called via this process called Sensor Fusion, which at the very end of this results in an actual estimate of the orientation of your device in space. Because if you take, for example, gyro rate data, you can add those up to sum them into the current rotation angle. You can correct that with the knowledge of which way is down through the accelerometer. And you can also correct that for drift by checking which way north is using the compass. So that provides a fairly accurate mechanism for knowing exactly how your object, your device, is being oriented or held by the user. And if you wanted to use that to do something like, say, have some object that is held on the screen in some fixed orientation no matter how you rotate the device around, this is the code that does that. Because the sensor that calls the orientation sensor that comes from Sensor Fusion provides a result in a quaternion. You take that quaternion and pass it into your rotation matrix of your 3D object that gets applied every frame, and then the object is effectively rotated to the correct orientation so that it always looks like it's fixed in space independent of which way you've rotated the cube, the device. So we use things like this in the marble maze application to determine whether which way the ball should roll based on how you've tilted the tablet. Okay, as I mentioned, we recognize that the game scenario is pretty important, so we added a library into the operating system that just does input from game controllers, like the Xbox 360 controller. There's a sample out there on the web today you can download. It's called Controller Sketch. It's actually implemented in JavaScript, but all the APIs are the same, pretty much, in C++. And you can use it to, you can use your, you can take your controller and plug it into the USB port and go. These are the you can basically pull for the button state. You'll get information. In this case, we want to make sure that the button was pressed before, so when we get a button up event, we only fire on that. Then it's also got a similar set of APIs around for the D-pads. The little joysticks on the controller let you determine the orientation of your thumb and what direction the player wants to go in. And then in our case, we can feed that information into the Marble Maze model for orientation of the device that gives you the physical movement of the marble as it's going through the maze. Okay, every game also needs sound effects. And again, like we did for X Input, we recognized that the game sound effects scenario was sufficiently unique to require a dedicated routine added to the operating system, a dedicated library called XAudio 2. This came from, it was used on the PC. I believe it was also available on Xbox for a while. This is the way the code works in our existing sample code. Fundamentally, you have to go in and create this mastering voice, which is the interface into the API itself. This is the media loader routine that we use to actually convert the sound file from its particular format into the format that we're using in this case. Then we turn that into what we call a voice. And then when the voice is completed, we can actually play it by setting up this state and then calling submit source buffer, which submits that buffer to effectively the sound cart, the sound subsystem, and then it streams those samples out the speakers. So it's a fairly simple system. The nice thing about this is you can submit multiple voices at different times, like with this start routine, and the downstream logic in this API will mix them together so that they sound nice. And if you don't do that, whichever one renders last would obliterate the previous one, or you'd get glitches and pauses as they take turns getting displayed or getting rendered. Okay. This is the last element that I really wanted to cover today. How do I get all those cool elements into my game, like sprites and textures and 3D models and so on? And the answer is you need an art pipeline. It's possible to set up a very, very minimal one, like if we've done in our samples, which is enough to get a small company started on. Some of these companies now there today admit that they spend more money processing and working on their tools and their art production pipeline than they do on actually coding. It's not surprising because a lot of these high-end shops will have like 100 artists and 5 to 10 programmers. So in that kind of scenario, you're going to have a lot of money invested in the art. But the way we've set this up today is you would start off with some, for example, an art asset like a shader. Maybe this is the shader that puts the bumps on my lizard head. And that's in HLSL format, which is readable by anybody. It loads up in the Visual Studio IDE. I can edit that. Anybody can edit that. I can save it. Hit F5. It goes fine. So when I actually do build it, we have this build step, which is included into the Visual Studio environment in this case, that launches the direct 3D HLSL compiler behind the scenes and converts that 3D shader file into a runtime version of the shader, a compiled version of the shader. And in the old days, that's what you would just use in your application. But with the Metro model, what happens is we have this packager inside the Visual Studio environment as well, or at least it's launched from there, that takes that shader and packages into your APEX file for uploading to the store. So that's how it gets where it's going. Now, this FXC and all of this support is built into Visual Studio, so there's nothing you have to do really as a developer other than not delete the build rules that make this work in your current project. But if you want to also make this work for textures, a lot of our samples have this same model used for texture data or sprites or image, any kind of image data. You're typically going to start with it in a file format that any authoring tool could emit, like bump or ping or JPEG or even PSD, potentially. And then there's a build rule in a lot of our samples that For example, there's a sample called resource loading that demonstrates this whole spectrum of techniques here. And it has an XE in it, a command line utility that takes the bump file and converts it into a runtime optimized version of that image, which is in this case .dds file, which is it's been compressed using a compression format that the GPUs are extremely good at reading from. So there's a lot of advantage to getting your texture into that format because it makes your package smaller, it makes the load time and download time for that over 3G potentially a lot better, and then it also is easier for the GPU to read because it's less bandwidth that it takes when it's actually displaying the graphics. And then for 3D models, there's a similar model where you can take a mesh in a standard format like FBX or OBJ, and then there's another command line utility that gets invoked as part of the build process that converts that into a runtime version, which in this case, it really converts it into those, remember I talked about a vertex buffer and an index buffer that the render routine calls? Those are what's in that last little file there, ready for use by the GPU. Now, in most of our samples, these routines are not built into the IDE like FXC is. These are provided as part of the sample in a little source code routine that gets built as a sub-project when you hit F5. And it turns the source code for that into a little command line XE, which then can be invoked and does the processing of that mesh when you hit F5. So what it means is once this is all up and running, any of your artists can modify any of these assets. As soon as they hit save, the next time anybody hits a build on the project, it will go and automatically figure out which art assets have been modified and only process the ones that need to be processed, and then package them all into the package and submit it. And of course, you can do a similar thing with a music. For example, you could keep all your authored sound effects in WAV files. You have a conversion tool. There are several out there that already do this, and invoke that on a similar command line, and then integrate that in WMA, because you really don't want to send uncompressed data in over 3G connection. And now you've got all my art assets packaged into my product just from me hitting F5 once in the Visual Studio IDE. Do you believe that? It actually kind of works. Okay, I just want to cover what happens at runtime, is that now we've submitted the application to the store, it's out there in a million people's machines, they all download it, the APEX file gets copied down to the machine, and then there's an installer process that takes all of these components that were in your APEX file, like your splash screen and all the art assets, and puts them out onto the hard drive of the user's machine. Now at that point, inside my application, the dotted line box, I'm calling loader routines that load the art data in each of those formats and do like we did with the render call my shaders, bind my shaders, load my textures, bind the vertex buffer data, and then set that data as your audio stream like we saw in the last slides about audio, and then I can just execute them. Right? So we've gone end to end. We've started with something that somebody created in Photoshop, and we've gone all the way through to getting it on the screen in an extremely efficient way. Okay, just have a couple tips that we've learned from experience here. One of the coolest things about the Visual Studio IDE is that there's a little text port in the upper right corner where you can type search strings, and they don't go out to Google. They actually search for what you want at that point, which is, what's the name of that command that I want to use to do something now? And so the Visual Studio IDE has, 50,000 commands probably? So having the ability to search through those via contextual text is a very useful thing. Another thing that we do when we're creating Metro-style applications is we set up a multi-mon system, kind of like I've got here actually, where you've set up a touch monitor as your primary. This works with the beta bits that are out there now. And you run all of your Metro stuff on that primary. And then you have your IDE, your VS tooling, on the monitor that's running classic desktop. And then you can, just by Alt-Tab, a little bit of focus games, you can step through code, you can have a very nice environment for developing Metro-style applications, where you don't have to keep switching back and forth between classic and desktop on the same screen all the time. It's a little bit tricky because these touch-based monitors today typically only support two fingers at a time. So if you're trying to write an application that's going to need five fingers, like some of these tablets can handle, then it's not a great solution for that. But for the typical scenarios that you're going to run into, which is things like pinch to zoom and so on, two fingers is usually enough. So it's not a bad experience. That's how we developed all our samples. And then there's another thing in here. There's what we've done to, again, keep the syntax clean for dealing with DirectX, which is COM objects. We used exceptions to handle all the error cases. And the trick to using those is if you set a breakpoint there, then you'll be able to see what the particular exception was caused by before it's too late. Okay, so this is the end of this talk. The point's the same. We've got this opportunity out there now. There's a lot of sample code. I just went through a tiny fraction of it that's really more focused on the extremely high-end Direct3D scenario. If you wanted to use JavaScript or HTML or XAML in your application, those all work too, just that I'm not an expert in those. And there are other people here who are more likely to help you out with those sorts of application scenarios. So if you're interested in the details of how to take an application that runs on a particular machine and make it run on all the machines that might happen to run Windows 8, then that's when you want to come to the next talk. So thanks very much.